From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. The 4th of July may be over, but questions about patriotism, American values, and what it means to be part of this country are often on our minds and ever-changing.
Our job is to push and stretch the boundaries of what it means to be American, to continually write a chapter in the evolving, messy, rough draft of America, and to bum rush the show, to quote Public Enemy.
But as American identity continues to evolve, many are still left out of the picture.
You may have spent your whole life dreaming about the United States, thinking about how cool it is and how you're a big part of it. But then when you go there, you find that people don't know anything about you and they don't care about you.
Today, we explore the complex question of what it means to be an American. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No te vayas. So we're psyched that you like Latino USA, and if you're looking for more to listen to, check out NPR One. The suggestions in NPR One are hand-curated to help you find the best from public radio and beyond. News and podcasts, NPR One is ready when you are. NPR One is on your app store. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. In the early 1940s, when George Takei was a child in Los Angeles, his family was forcibly relocated and incarcerated in camps in Arkansas and Northern California during the Japanese-American internment. Despite being U.S. citizens, he and his family and thousands of other Japanese-Americans were stripped of their rights and branded enemies. For George Takei, it was a betrayal of American values, and it defined his childhood and later his role as a civil rights activist.
Space, a final frontier.
Now you might recognize George Takei as Sulu from Star Trek.
Mr. Spock has orders to kill you, Captain. He will succeed.
In recent years, he also starred in the Broadway musical Allegiance, inspired by his family's experience during the internment. And as an openly gay Asian American actor, he's become a prominent face of the LGBTQ rights movement, using social media and humor and geek culture to push back against homophobia and bigotry. Today, we're basing our show around these questions. What does it mean to be American? And what are American values? And it turns out that those are pretty complicated questions. By the way, in Spanish, America, or América, refers to both continents of North and South America, which can cause some confusion. But for today's context, we're going to be using the term American to refer to people from the United States. And so to start us off, I recently spoke with George Takei about his family's experiences, and he talked about what it means to be part of American democracy. George Takei, it is great to have you on Latino USA. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's wonderful to be here with you.
So you talk a lot about the internment and how it affected your life. Your family basically rounded up by armed soldiers, by American citizens who were essentially just like you and forced into camps. So what do you remember about that time?
My actual experience in imprisonment was one that, you know, I was 5 years old. I adjusted to. Children are amazingly adaptable. I still remember the barbed wire fences that confined me. I remember the sentry tower with machine guns pointed down at us. I remember the searchlight that followed me when I made the night runs from our barrack to the latrine. And for my parents, that was an invasive light, a degrading, a humiliating light. But for me, as a five-year-old running to the latrine, I thought it was nice that they lit the way for me to pee, you know. So, to be very honest, my very real memories of that imprisonment was playing with the other kids, exploring, catching ants and putting them in a jar filled with dirt, memories like that. But when I became a teenager, I was reading civics books and history books and reading about the shining ideals of our democracy, our freedom, our liberty, our justice. And I couldn't quite reconcile that with my what I knew to be my childhood imprisonment.
Now, during that imprisonment, George, because of wartime hysteria, you and your family were actually considered the enemy.
We were literally labeled enemy aliens. My mother was born in Sacramento. My father was a San Franciscan. We looked like the enemy, and so we became labeled, categorized as the enemy.
Essentially, it's impossible to reconcile American ideals, these American ideals of freedom and justice, with that kind of racism and hatred. So, were you angry?
So I had many after-dinner conversations with my father, and I challenged him a lot. And I, to this day, regret much of the challenges I made to him, because he was the one that suffered the most in our family.
What were you challenging your father on?
Why did you go, Daddy? I would have gone downtown and I would have protested. I would have fought it. And my father, you know, was deeply wounded by that. But it was that same man who lost everything in the middle of his life who explained to me about our democracy. And he told me the story of this attorney general in California, right after Pearl Harbor. He said, we have no reports of spying or sabotage, and that is ominous, because the Japanese are inscrutable. You don't know what they're thinking, so it would be prudent for us to lock them up before they do anything. The reason why he took that position, when he knew better, was because he was ambitious, and my father told me that was his fallibility. And sure enough, he became very popular for that stance, and that man, that former attorney general, that former governor of California, went on to be the chief justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. His name is Earl Warren, the great, in quotes, liberal Supreme Court chief justice.
Where do you, you know, in these moments where we are being challenged, where do you go to find optimism in the face of hysteria that Americans and America does so well?
As my father said, our democracy is dependent on people who cherish the ideals of democracy and actively participate in the process, because we have a history of not quite being true to those ideals.
It seems like you're incredibly optimistic, George, about...
You don't believe my optimism.
No, I admire it. I admire it.
One afternoon, my father took me downtown to the Adlai Stevenson for President headquarters, and he said, this is how democracy works. I had listened to Adlai Stevenson's speeches on the radio. He was an inspiring speaker, and to be there with other passionate people who were working day and night to elect Governor Stevenson of Illinois, the President of the United States, gave me an understanding of what a participatory democracy was. Because resentment means that you're already defeated. You can't get anything done. And in a democracy, rules of the game is majority. You work with others. The founding fathers who articulated those ideals kept other human beings as slaves. Women didn't have any rights under the founding fathers. But because determined women challenged and debated and marched for equal rights of women, that now we have equality for women. And at this point in America in 2016, we have the real possibility of a woman becoming the President of the United States. Here we are at this point in 200 plus years of this country that started out with high ideals, but very little of that applied to the majority of people. And yet we are making progress. And even looking more focused, I'm a gay American, a gay Japanese American. My ethnic community is very conservative. And so, you know, being gay, in the Japanese American community, there's that saying, the nail that sticks out gets pounded in. And yet I stuck out and I advocated for equality as the history of this country does. State by state, we started getting marriage equality. And so in just my focused, limited lifetime, not the big scope of American history, we've made amazing progress.
So you talk about being gay, which now is a really big part of your activism, your, you know, activism on behalf of LGBTQ rights. But did you ever talk to your dad about coming out? And did that actually kind of influence your decision to speak out and become an activist?
I was a reticent activist. I was someone who had the regular father-son dialogue. And as I said, sometimes it got pretty heated. And I feel badly about those times that I think I hurt my father a lot in those debates. There were times that he just got up and walked into the bedroom and closed the door. And I realized I'd hurt him. And so I felt like knocking on the door and say, "Daddy, I'm sorry. I didn't mean that." But I didn't. And I thought, well, I'll apologize tomorrow morning when we're fresh and awake. And when tomorrow morning came, it was awkward. And I didn't. And for some of those mornings when I didn't apologize, it's a great painful regret that I have in my life. You know, my hero, and I hurt him. But he was an example. He was hurt many times in his life, and he was still able to give me guidance and take me downtown to the Hadley Stevenson for President headquarters, and he's my inspiration. And I was silent on being gay for a long time. In fact, I never came out to my father before he died. I came out very late in life, and that also gave me the determination to make up for that silence with my father. Another way of saying, "I apologize, Daddy, that I didn't come out to you," because I know, I'm sure he would have understood, because you pay a price and you realize that you have to keep paying that price. In part, apology to my father, but the other part, to his belief in the ultimate prevailing of justice under the system. He's the one that guided me into understanding what it means to be an American.
And George, actually, can you just say, what is your dad's name?
Takekuma Norman Takei. And my mother's name was Fumiko Emily Takei. And they are my heroes.
George, I just want to say thank you so much for being a central part of American history.
Well, thank you for this opportunity to have a very heartfelt conversation.
And to hear more thoughts from George Takei, visit Latino USA. And there you can watch my Facebook Live interview with him. Coming up on Latino USA, when the country you fight for doesn't fight for you.
This is my home. I want to be here, but I can't get the help that I need. It's not the help I want. It's the help I need.
That's coming up. Stay with us. No te vayas.
Bye.
Before we get back to our show on what it is to be an American, I wanted to read you a note that we got from a recent new donor. Her name is Katie, and she's from Kentucky. She writes, I first listened to Latino USA for a class assignment, but since then, the program has become a part of my daily routine. Latino USA gives me incredible insight into a world I was not really exposed to while growing up in rural eastern Kentucky. Gracias por todo. Thank you, Katie, for your support and for your note. If you can, I hope that you'll consider joining Katie and amazing listeners just like her by going to latinousa.org and clicking on the donate button. And maybe you'll consider supporting us with a monthly gift. Every single penny that you donate makes a big impact in our independent media. And there's one more favor. If you can take a second and go to iTunes to rate and review Latino USA, this really helps us to get new listeners. And the comments that you write, we love them. So keep them coming. Gracias, Katie, and to all of you for listening.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl, with flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide. More at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities through grant making and social investing. More at kresge.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Now, what does it mean to be an American when you don't have the ability to vote in a presidential election? And when you live on an island that's 6,000 miles away from the continental United States? Well, for the residents of Guam, an unincorporated U.S. territory in the South Pacific, being an American often means enrolling in the military. Guam is tiny. It has only about 200,000 people, and of that, about 14,000 are veterans. But in recent years, Guam has ranked last in terms of medical care spending per veteran by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. So limited resources, staff, and facilities actually prevent these veterans from accessing the medical care they need and that they deserve. For many Guamanians, joining the military may create a sense of belonging and a sense of American identity. But does it come at a cost? Back in 2014, I visited Guam myself to meet some of the island's wounded warriors and hear their stories. Every July 21st, Guam celebrates the American liberation of the island from the Japanese during World War II with a huge throw-out-all-the-stops parade. One after another, blocks-long contingents of Guamanian American soldiers march.
You know, Guam is very traditional when it comes to the military.
That's Sergeant First Class Gonzalo Fernandez, a recruiter for the National Guard.
In every village on Guam, you're going to find a big amount of people who served in the military in some capacity. It's a family tradition to do it.
That tradition makes it an easy place to get people to sign up. In fact, Fernandez has won the Guard's Recruiter of the Year award 3 times in a row.
The success I have here, I probably couldn't duplicate anywhere else because I'm not sure that the people of those places are as patriotic as the people on this island.
In fact, Guamanians serve at a rate 3 times higher than the rest of the country. Part of it may have to do with the military's massive presence on the island. Guam is known as the tip of the spear in the Pacific. 30% of the island is occupied by military bases.
If you look there, you can see that's the port of Guam. And right over there, you've got U.S. Navy Base Guam, one of the several U.S. military installations on Guam.
University of Guam history professor Michael Bivacqua took me to see where the American Marines landed in Guam in 1944.
When you look at Guam today, you may not sort of ever imagine that just 2 generations ago it was a battlefield. But if you look, you can still see scars everywhere. You can see them in the landscape. You can see them on the people, in the stories that people tell, in the identities that they feel.
One of those scars, Bivacqua says, is its unequal relationship with the United States.
Some people say, oh, Guam, wow, Central America. Guam, really, you look so light for an African. This is a hard fact that a lot of people, when they go to the States, they realize is that you may have spent your whole life dreaming about the United States, thinking about how cool it is and how you're a big part of it. But then when you go there, you find that people don't know anything about you and they don't care about you.
So if you translate that sense of invisibility to what's happening in terms of Guamanians and Pacific Islanders and their military service.
Let's say you live your whole life on Guam and then you feel this sort of rejection from the United States. I really think that it does have this problem of, you know, people feeling like they're shut out of America, and so some people join to try and prove that they're really a part of the United States.
Is that what it's about?
No, that's part of it, though. But in truth, a lot of it has to do with the shininess and the niceness of the military. You know, and just there's all this excess of, it seems like there's this excess of resources.
Nearly a quarter of Guam's population lives in poverty. So for many Guamanians, the military is a way out. But whatever their reasons may be for joining, coming home after serving presents soldiers with a whole new set of challenges. Pacific Islanders not only serve at the highest rates, they are injured and die at the highest rates too. But Guam ranked dead last in medical care spending per veteran by the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs in 2012. In recent years, many servicemen and women have been returning from the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq with physical and psychological scars. And many say they have trouble obtaining the care they need.
This is where the IED went off.
One of those vets is Roland Atta, a 34-year-old who served two tours in Iraq as a combat medic. In his home on Guam, he showed me pictures of a roadside bombing he witnessed in which several Iraqi men and children were killed.
This kid here was, he was on fire when we rolled up. He was already dead when we got there.
Today, Roland suffers from severe post-traumatic stress disorder because of experiences such as these.
Those photographs of dead children.
Mm-hmm. I still see them every once in a while. That's why I get drunk, so I don't have to see them. Or if I get drunk, or it numbs everything for me.
Some days, he says, he feels incapable of even leaving the house. He says he has frequent thoughts of suicide. The first time was towards the end of his active service, while he was on base in Hawaii.
I was mad at the world. I was mad at everybody. I was mad at myself. And that's what scares me, is when I do get mad, is stuff like that. Those fleeting thoughts could become real. That's why I get scared of myself.
Because it's not just hurting yourself, but maybe
other people.
Roland wants to get better, but he says he's been unable to find the intensive PTSD treatment he needs here in Guam. In fact, the nearest VA program offered is in Hawaii, 8 hours away by plane.
Sometimes I think going back to the States and have a better care, I guess you could say. And it sucks because this is my home. I want to be here, but I can't get the help that I need. It's not the help I want. It's the help I need.
The VA doesn't operate a hospital in Guam. It did, however, open a new clinic for veterans in 2011.
This is like a big doctor's office, is what this is. We don't do overnight stay. So
Craig Oswald is an official with the VA health system based in Hawaii. Because there were no official agency representatives in Guam, the VA flew him in to meet with me.
We've got a board-certified full-time psychiatrist, two of them, here on island.
Is that enough?
To treat veterans.
You feel like having two psychiatrists on the island to treat veterans. Is that enough? Do you wish there was
right
more?
I think right now we're doing well.
I pressed him on what I'd been hearing from veterans about a lack of services, and specifically what Roland had said about the treatment he needs for his PTSD.
He kind of feels like there's the services that he needs do not exist on the island where he lives. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When you hear that, what goes on for you?
Well, we're very concerned about hearing that from veterans. We have been building a healthcare system here in the Pacific, particularly over the last 20 years, to try to meet what we call unmet demand. All I know is that in an area like the Pacific, we have grown tremendously our capabilities to help these people over the years, and we have future plans to go even further.
But not everybody would agree with Oswald's claims that things are getting better. Governor Eddie Calvo, the highest elected official on the island, told me that the U.S. Senate cut funds for mental health care for Guam vets 2 years in a row.
Unfortunately, some of the policymakers out there in Washington, D.C., they have a pretty cavalier attitude towards the citizenry out here in Guam. Of course, it doesn't help that we're an unincorporated territory that has no vote in a Congress or a Senate, or has no vote for a president. And with that, it makes it that much more difficult to getting our voices heard.
Is the United States right now living up to its commitment to Guam in terms of what it's doing for the veterans?
The federal government has not done their part to assist a very patriotic group of American citizens fighting in so many distant lands, fighting for the freedoms of folks in areas that have never tasted democracy, yet really have not felt what true democracy is all about. What do you call a people that cannot vote for their representatives that make the laws? To not offend anyone, I guess I'll keep it as a non-self-governing territory. But I guess in a 19th century sense, you could call it a colony.
For Governor Calvo, Guam's lack of federal representation is the biggest hurdle in securing further resources for the island's veterans. Until those resources arrive, vets like Roland Otta may have to either leave the island for care or learn to get by on their own and hope they make it out without hurting themselves or others. Roland knows his family is worried about him.
You know, every night when I go out to shoot pool or when I go out to go drink, I don't want them to have to worry that, is he going to make it home tonight? And the only thing that kind of snaps me back to reality is kind of like, I got to think of my family.
That piece first aired in 2014, and since we reported that story, the Guam Vet Center and the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs have made some improvements for their members. They now have more access to new facilities on the island, and they have more funding to expand those services. But the Guam Vet Center reports that the number of mental health care professionals hasn't changed. Now, as Americans, one of the things that we value most is our freedom of speech. And there's a good reason for that, because free speech isn't a given in all countries of the world. Dissident writers can be jailed, harassed, even killed. For them, often the only solution is to leave their homeland. In Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a nonprofit called City of Asylum gives persecuted foreign writers a new home and a new space to create in. Erica Barras has our story.
For decades, Henry Reese has lived here on Sampsonia Way.
This block is 20 feet wide, roughly, and it's about 800 feet long. And there are houses only on one side, and there are garages and fences on the other side.
When Henry moved into this alley, many of the houses were blighted. He bought a few of them and fixed them up. Now the houses are safe havens for writers in exile from all over the world.
In certain countries, it can be very difficult to write, and whether it be in Iran or China or Turkey, even places we may think of as fairly free. And we've seen even now in France, there can be difficulties of a different sort.
Henry is a retired businessman and lifelong book lover. 12 years ago, he saw the famously persecuted novelist Salman Rushdie speak. It made him want to offer sanctuary to other writers with similar problems.
Literary writers, we felt it was important to protect because they don't have any institutional protection.
That's why he decided to start City of Asylum. It offers persecuted writers a new home in countries where they're free to write. There are City of Asylum programs in Europe funded by governments, and there are some in the U.S. affiliated with universities. Henry wanted his City of Asylum to be independent and in a community. The first author to come live on the street was Huang Shang, a Chinese poet who spent 12 years in prison. This is a YouTube recording of Huang reading. He was so happy to be free to write, he often performed in front of his house, drawing neighbors who didn't understand his words, but understood his exuberance. And Hoang started a tradition, house poems, that is, pieces of writing actually painted on a house's exterior. Since then, City of Asylum has drawn writers from El Salvador, Burma, and India.
After all, what could be colder than a world that will not even acknowledge your presence?
Usually a writer who comes to City of Asylum gets a place to live for 2 years and help to stay in the country legally. The writer who's been on the alley the longest since 2011 is Israel Centeno. In Venezuela, Israel was a celebrated author. Then he wrote The Conspiracy. He says just the opening lines got him in trouble.
En Buenos Aires se llama bruma. En Ciudad de México le dicen neblumo.
In Buenos Aires, it's called mist. In Mexico City, they call it smog. When the wind blows from the Sahara and covers Santa Cruz de Tenerife, the islanders know it as a haze. And I was moving through smoke and ashes on the day I went out to kill the president.
El día en que salí a matar al presidente.
The Conspiracy is about an assassination attempt on the country's president. It was published in 2002, just months after a failed coup against Hugo Chavez, who was then president. The government found that suspicious.
There were no charges. The police didn't grab me. Those things don't happen in Venezuela. The repression in Venezuela happens in other ways.
Israel spent years being harassed. Once a stranger hit him as he was getting out of the subway. Someone tapped his phone. He thinks it was the government. Militant leftist groups gave him death threats. For his wife, Graciela Bonet, the move to the U.S. was especially hard. When she was 17 in the 70s, her family had to leave her native Argentina because of a repressive dictatorship. In comparison, Venezuela had been a haven.
It was magnificent, and the people who lived there didn't realize all they had, because they had never suffered that kind of loss. We were coming from an extreme situation, very difficult, a disastrous government with persecutions. So it seemed amazing.
Now that's no longer the case. Israel and Graciela left Venezuela for many of the same reasons. Because of his artistic talent, the U.S. gave him a permanent green card. But starting a new life in their 50s has been difficult. Israel felt he had no choice.
It wasn't just to survive. It wasn't just to avoid getting killed. It wasn't just avoiding something bad happening to me. It was to keep writing.
To keep writing is a common drive on Sampsonia Way. A few doors down from where Israel lives is City of Asylum's latest author, Yagub Yadali, an Iranian who moved here in 2013. He doesn't speak Spanish, and Israel doesn't speak Farsi, but the two have bonded.
A country like Venezuela, which has some similarity to my country, we have many things to share with each other about our experiences, about our professional background, about our experiences in real life in our countries.
Like Israel, Yagub has slowly started making a life for himself in Pittsburgh, performing in the alley.
Salam bar Pittsburgh. Hello, Pittsburgh.
And writing frequently, which he didn't have the space to do back home. Israel, too, has been writing, still in Spanish, since coming to the U.S. His latest book begins in Venezuela and ends in Pittsburgh.
That story came to us from Erica Barras. Coming up on Latino USA, we get into the nitty-gritty of what being an American means.
Damn right I'm American. I'll be damned if I let anyone ever take that away from me. I was born and raised in this country, and not only am I going to fight for the American narrative and the American dream, I'm going to fight to be the protagonist of the American narrative with a multisyllable, trisyllabic name with brown skin who drinks chai.
That's coming up. Stay with us. No te vayas. Thanks for listening to Latino USA. You know, Hidden Brain is the NPR podcast about social science that you can apply to everyday life. Things like how being busy affects our motivation, and when personalization online leads to discrimination on Airbnb. Find the Hidden Brain podcast with NPR's Shankar Vedantam at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, whose National Hispanic Advisory Council is devoted to educating the Hispanic community about the causes, treatment, and prevention of cancer. Learn more at cancercenter.com. And the Walton Family Foundation, working to prepare all students for a lifetime of opportunity by ensuring access to high-quality K-12 choices. More information is available at waltonk12.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And on this episode, we've been asking the question, who is an American? Now, some people are American by birth, others by choice. But for some, it's more complicated. Tom Molina Duarte was born in Costa Rica to Afro-Latino parents, but he was adopted by a white American family and raised in the United States. He's among the 85% of all internationally adopted children who are of a different race or ethnicity from their adoptive parents. And for him, that caused a lot of friction. That is, until he decided to make a change. And a warning now, this piece contains some strong language.
I told my parents, and I said it pretty matter-of-fact, like they were both in the kitchen, and I said, I've decided to change my last name from Kylie to Molina Duarte. Here are the reasons why I'm doing it. My name is Tom Molina Duarte. I am 28 years old. I live in Detroit, grew up in Connecticut, and was adopted as a baby from Costa Rica. I actually was raised to say that I was Costa Rican and that I was not black. I have brown skin, brown eyes, curly black hair. I definitely have African features, so I have a broad nose and big lips. My parents look like mainstream white folks from the suburbs. So I knew from an early age that I was adopted. You see some kind of representation of Costa Rica. It's often a toucan and like a beach in the rainforest. And I remember making a toucan out of papier-mâché when I was probably in first or second grade. And just there was so much wrapped up in that toucan for me. That's like what I had. That was my connection to Costa Rica, was a papier-mâché toucan. Which for me clearly illustrates how the opportunities that were given to me to connect with my past were not good enough. So I went to a public high school and could point to multiple instances, even in a day, of like being treated differently because my skin is brown. I've been called a in front of an entire classroom. Oh, you're very articulate. What are you mixed with? I've been coded as a threat. So my senior year, I was the state president of the National Honor Society. And I made some speech. And I just remember the parents afterwards almost being like surprised that I was state president. Surprised at how I spoke, how I carried myself. There were a lot of backhanded compliments, like, I like that Tom Kiley. He's not like other young black men or young Latino men. My teacher's white. All of my friends are white. Everyone in the class is white. My parents are white. And I knew that at the age of 15, I knew that they couldn't help me. So I developed a deep, deep sense of shame about myself. And to be completely honest, in high school and in college, I self-medicated pretty heavily through drinking and smoking pot. Tom Kiley started to feel like a falsehood after I graduated college. I was 26 years old, dealing with another really bad bout of depression, and just knew that something needed to change. So I started to see a therapist, and when talking about adoption and race together, like having someone else actually say out loud, like, you know, that's really messed up that you dealt with a lot of racism in your life, or that's really messed up that you're afraid of what will happen if you bring that up with your parents. That was like the first chipping away of isolation. Duarte Molina, that's the name that's listed on my birth certificate. So traditionally, the paternal last name is first and the maternal last name is second in Latino cultures. And I decided to switch them as a way to honor my biological mother. I told my parents I am changing my name because I want to have a more authentic representation of who I am. And I think that me being more honest with what I need and who I am means that I'm going to have more capacity to be more loving and open to my parents. They got quiet, and then my mom started to cry. And a couple of days later, we had a phone conversation about it, and she told me how upset she was and felt like I was rejecting the last 28 years of my life and that I was rejecting them, but like continued to say, even while she was crying, like, I get it, I understand it. But my name change is definitely still something we're talking about. In a lot of ways, this feels like almost like a reward of like, I earned the right to be able to say with confidence, my name is Tom Molina Duarte. So it feels really good.
That story was produced by Nina Patak. Now, from one man questioning his own identity, we go to another man who is questioning the American identities of quite a few people. Ever since Donald Trump became a viable political candidate, he has sparked important questions about who can and should be seen as American. From his call to ban Muslims from entering the country to his suggestion that a Mexican-American judge, Gonzalo Curiel, could not possibly be impartial in a lawsuit over Trump University.
But I have a judge who is a hater of Donald Trump. A hater. He's a hater. His name is Gonzalo Curiel.
Behind all this rhetoric, there's a consistent theme. Donald Trump wants to define who's an American. Recently, though, many people across the entire political spectrum have begun questioning Trump's own American-ness. There was Republican Senator Lindsey Graham responding to Trump's comments about Judge Curiel.
I think it's un-American. I think it runs against who we are as a people, and I'll have no part of it.
After Trump's call for a Muslim ban, Democratic Senator Harry Reid took to the Senate floor.
It's reprehensible and un-American for the nominee of any major party to declare millions of Americans guilty and to prove innocent purely by virtue of their religion.
And after hearing his fellow Republicans call for banning mosques, MSNBC's Joe Scarborough was defiant.
Let me look straight into the camera so this can never be wiped clean. That's un-American.
But is it un-American?
And who gets to decide what is and isn't American? I spoke with writer Veronica Valletti Flores after the Orlando shooting, and this is what she had to say.
What Trump is saying is actually very American. I think that racism and colonization is actually what this country is largely built on. And we like to talk about how this country was built on freedom, but it was also built on slaves and on the genocide of indigenous people and on the oppression of folks like LGBTQ Latinos. So in some sense, I think it sounds very un-American what Trump is saying. But on the other hand, I think that it's actually distinctly American.
So again, what does it mean to be an American? It's a question that we're constantly asking on In the Thick, which is the political podcast that we produce here at the Futuro Media Group. On a recent episode of In the Thick, I spoke with Veronica Valletti Flores, along with our political editor, Julio Ricardo Varela, and with playwright and commentator Wajahat Ali, who got our conversation started.
I think what Donald Trump represents, it's this competing darkness that is rooted within American soil, which is, I think, rooted, let's be honest, with racist violence and racial violence. We have to acknowledge the fact that we have these foundations, the Supreme Court, Congress, the White House, these buildings that espouse the values of freedom and tolerance, these American values that we cherish and that we export to the world, the beacon, which is why so many immigrants have come to this country. My family, for example, Pakistani immigrants, Muslims. And yet, those same foundations that espouse these values were built by slaves, black men, women, and children who were denied their humanity. And 15% to 30% of the slave trade that was brought over here forcibly against its will was Muslim.
So what does it mean to be American for you? As a college student, I will say, yeah, I was like, no me digas que soy americana. But now, at this point in my life, I'm like, oh, no, no, no. I am an American citizen. My husband is. My kids are. We live here. This is my country. I am 100% American. And I tell my students, you have to own your Americanness and call yourself American.
You know, I think, Maria, I agree with you. When I wasn't born in this country, I was naturalized a few years ago. And when I go back to Venezuela, I'm a gringa, you know? And even though Americans might not be ready to accept me, I do see myself as being part of a long, long legacy of resistance, right? I'm not the first person to have these opinions. Indigenous people here whose land was taken away fought back. Slaves fought back. And that has a legacy in America, too. And I'm part of that.
If we weren't allowed to have these rights, you know, to express ourselves, to resist, the ability to resist, that to me is a fundamental, like, right that very few people in this world have. And I take that sort of sense of expression is to be inherently American. And so that's where I feel like I have the right to say that, you know, America, this country is not exceptional. And I'm not going to get, you know, I can say that right now. I could say it out in New York City, and I'm just as proudly American as anybody else.
What about you, Waj?
Damn right I'm American. I'll be damned if I let anyone ever take that away from me. I was born and raised in this country. And not only am I going to fight for the American narrative and the American dream, I'm going to fight to be the protagonist of the American narrative with a multisyllable, trisyllabic name with brown skin who drinks chai when he kisses his wife, who was the high school cheerleader. And I'm going to make sure that my son, Ibrahim, who's 2 years old, will grow up in America where he, too, can say, you know what, maybe I can be president. And all that matters is my character and my, you know, goodwill. And if I can raise a lot of money from lobbyists. But why not me? If I, too, can be, you know, why not Ibrahim Ali? And it's our job, especially, you know, it's a tough burden, especially for a person of color. If you're a minority, if you're a Muslim, you can, you know, fill in the blank if you want to empathize. But our job is to push and stretch the boundaries of what it means to be American, to continually write a chapter in the evolving, messy, rough draft of America, and to bum rush the show, to quote Public Enemy from the late 80s and early 90s, because no one's going to give it to us. Even though, yes, it is a right according to its values, what we've seen in the underbelly of America is that there's a darkness that wants to rob us of our dignity, of our rights, of our place, of our rightful place in this story.
And we're saying no.
Hell no. Yeah. I'm American. You say you're American? Well, I'm just as American as you, and I'm going to prove I'm even more American than you by basically living out these values that you celebrate but don't necessarily live up to. I'm going to do it for not only myself, but for all Americans.
Veronica, are you proud to be an American? You had to raise that right hand just like me and pledge to this country.
I'm not going to lie, Maria. It was very, very difficult. It was very difficult to sign those papers. It was very emotional for me.
Why was it difficult?
It was difficult, Maria, because I think that part of the reason why I am in the United States is because of the United States. When you look at the United States as a global superpower and the foreign policy and the economic policy, it's caused a lot of trouble in South America. It's caused a lot of trouble where I'm from. And the economic devastation that forces people to come to this country is not out of thin air. It's because of foreign policy. It's because of decisions that are often and largely made in the United States. So I am an American because I've been displaced from a country that I called home, and now I'm here, and now this is my home. And yes, I'm super excited that there's so many rights that I have and that I can say that on here and nobody's going to come arrest me. But I also read the news that the NYPD just gave up a huge vault of all of the files that they from when they spied on the Young Lords, from when they spied on right. the Black Panthers. Mm-hmm. So it's not quite as easy as we have the right to say whatever we want. And there's no consequence for that. And I think that it's not quite as easy as I'm in the United States and I'm proud to be here because I think the United States has a hand in me being here.
And Julio, are you proud?
Yeah, why not?
That's not a great answer.
No,
yeah, why not?
But that's my question. Why are you questioning? Yeah. Do I sit here? Do I have to wrap myself around the flag and be like, you know, sing I'm proud to be an American? Like, do I have to do that? No, my America is a very different type of America. It's places that are reflect sort of a world, a changing country that is for the better.
And Waj, proud?
I am. I'll tell you, I live in a very interesting time with an interesting identity because in America, I'm asked, why does Islam hate us? And when I travel abroad, and I often do, I'm asked to represent America, and Muslims ask me, why does the West hate us? And simultaneously, I'm both us and them. As an American Muslim living in 2016 America, right? In 2016 the world. And it's fascinating that I always defend both. I defend Muslims, Islam, I defend America. But listen, I still think, and many American Muslims still think, that America is the best place for a Muslim to be an open practicing Muslim. Yes, even now in 2016 America with Trump, with the 1.6 billion proposed ban, many of us still say, if you gave us a choice of any country in the world right now, including Muslim majority countries, where can you be fully openly, authentically Muslim and still have a shot at the dream, if it's the American dream, the global dream, or just the dream of success and happiness. And I guarantee you, based on all the polls and stats, most American Muslims would say, I'll still stick with the American project. I'll invest my roots here.
Thanks to Noam Hassenfeld for producing that story. The conversation first appeared on the political podcast In the Thick. Now, here in New York City, where we're based, you can find almost every aspect of that American project. This is a place where almost every country and culture in the world is represented, and especially in Times Square. People from every corner of the country and beyond pass through there. So for today's sabiduría, or words of wisdom, we sent a few of our interns to the heart of New York City to ask people, what, for them, does it mean to be an American?
Oh, that's such a hard question. You know, we do some good things. I think we're good people, friendly people.
I'd say, I guess, to be prideful, family-oriented, kind to others. That's what I think about when it means to be American. Is that truly what it is? Probably not.
I cannot say I consider myself half American because I've just been here for 1 year, but if I stay longer, maybe I will say that. That's my goal.
I consider myself to be American, even though I was born in Mexico, but I've been living here for 17 years. Once my friends, they're like, oh, well, you're not from America. Why do you say you're American? This and that. Well, you know, I've lived here. I have to take pride of where I live. I have to accept the culture. So it's not where I come from, it's where I'm right now. And I'm proud to be an American. I'm proud to be living here in the U.S.
I guess the question about American values is, freedom of religion, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom from want,
Hi, my name is Nicole Dumas. I'm 28, about to be 29, and I'm from Trinidad and Tobago. I'm not really sure what it means to be American, per se. My boyfriend is American, so our cultures are a little bit different, so it's a little hard for us sometimes. You guys have a lot of liberties, a lot of freedoms that a lot of other people don't have. It's really nice that your country is so large because you can go to different areas and you get a all-rounded perspective.
I'm proud in some ways to be an American. Sometimes I'm not proud to be an American.
More often than not, I am proud, but with all the different things going on in the nation and in our nation's past, I guess, you know, there's a lot to be ashamed of as an American.
I'm an American and I'm happy to be one. I was born here. If I got to be anywhere, this is the place to be.
You heard the voices of Victoria McNulty, Destiny Powell, Mariela Bastibas, Paul Gregory, Nicole Dumas, Luis Martinez, and Joel Allen. And thanks to our interns, Sophia Boyd, Kalalia, and Reynaldo Leaños Jr. for putting together our piece. That's it for today. Latino USA is produced by Marlon Bishop, Lita Hartman, Fernanda Chavarri, Michael Simon Johnson, Zakia Gibbons, and Skylar Swenson. Julia Hsu is our production assistant. Our engineer and music editor is Cornelius McMoyler. Our interns are Sophia Boyd, Kalalia, Reynaldo Leaños Jr., and Brandon Nix. If you enjoyed the music that you heard on this episode and you want to learn more, stop by latinousa.org and check out our weekly Spotify playlist. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and I'll see you on Instagram. Ciao!
Latino USA is made possible in part by Carnegie Corporation, promoting the advancement of knowledge and understanding, with support from the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, and Unbound Philanthropy, ensuring that migrants and refugees are valued, treated with respect, and are able to build relationships of mutual engagement with their new communities.
I was just afraid of, like, extraterrestrial, something dark, you know.
Mm.
And so that's because it's the only explanation that I can have.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working with others to build a culture of health, enabling all in America's diverse society to lead healthier lives, now and for generations to come, on the web at rwjf.org. And Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org. This is NPR.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, a man dies in a U.S. immigrant detention center under unusual circumstances.
I still don't know what to think. Some of these letters say that he did commit suicide, and some of these say that he didn't.
Part one of our two-part investigation into the strange death of José de Jesús Denis Sahagún, next time on Latino USA.